Web TV Takeover, Part 1. This was recorded at the 8th Chimag Live event, Web TV Takeover, on September the 18th, 2007, in London. Featuring on the panel, Cosmo Lush, Head of Product Development at Channel 4's 4OD service, Raghav Gupta, VP International Partnerships at Brightcove, Paul Pod, co-founder of Tape It Off the Internet, Alexander Cameron, Managing Director of Digital TX Limited, and Alan Patrick, co-founder of Broadsight, with Colin Donald of Futurescape chairing. The event was produced by Chinwag editor Deirdre Molloy, with podcast services provided by Perfect Path Consulting.
Well, it's great to see such a large turnout tonight. You, the audience, are a mixture of new media people, techies, creators, broadcasters, and independent television producers. And we have a similar panel up here to talk through all the issues about what's going to be a revolution in television. And since we're talking about revolutions, a historical parallel sprang to mind. It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. It was the age of wisdom, the age of foolishness. The epoch of belief, the epoch of incredulity. The season of light, the season of darkness. And if you're Chad Hurley and Steve Chen, and you sold YouTube for $1.65 billion, you might be forgiven for taking the form of you. Of course, if you're a Viacom lawyer, toiling away, sending out tens of thousands of copyright takedowns every day, you might be forgiven for taking a more pessimistic view. Somewhere in between, there's the rest of us. With the panel tonight, we'll be trying to navigate our way through the television revolution and figure out who's going to the guillotine and who's doing the knitting. So, with the panel, we're going to be doing business models and how independent television production is going to change, how the broadcasters are dealing with it, new patterns of consumption, distribution, and production. And let's get through to introducing the panel, starting with Raghav Gupta.
Hi. I'm Raghav, or everybody calls me Rags, that's my nickname, Gupta from Brightcove. I'm Vice President of International Partnerships. I just relocated to London as of yesterday, so if I fall asleep, you'll have to excuse me during the panel to the jet lag. Brightcove is an internet TV service, and we have a software on demand service, and we work with a range of media companies from the smallest mom and pop filmmakers all the way to the largest media companies in the world, and help them distribute, publish, syndicate, monetize their video online. And we've had a lot of luck working with a lot of great companies. We just recently announced the opening of our UK office, and are working with some great brands in the UK, including Sky, Sony BMG, The Telegraph, Shine, Mo Media, and a number of others that we haven't yet announced. So that's gone very well. I'll also very quickly point out my colleague, Nick. Nick, if you want to raise your hand, he's the business development director of our office, and he's the one who told me to wear tweed tonight, so I blame him. I sort of said, so Nick, I'm in the UK, what do I wear? And he said, oh, go tweed with the leather elbow patches. So there you go, Nick. We're very pleased to be here, and we are very committed to the UK market, and it's very interesting to see the developments here, and we look forward to a great session here tonight. Thank you.
Cosmo Lush. I work at Channel 4, where I head up the product management for our video on demand service, 4OD. I'm sure we'll be talking in more detail about 4OD as the evening goes on, but in brief, it's a PC and TV-based video on demand service. You can get it either over the internet on your computer or through Virgin Media TV, Tiscali TV, and even BT Vision. So I've been at Channel 4 since we launched the service back in December, but not more than that, so I'm a relative newcomer to Channel 4. Before that, I was at what was then Home Choice and is now Tiscali TV, learning the ins and outs of on-demand and IPTV. And prior to that, I spent several years in the world of mobile phones, firstly at 3, with the launch of 3, and then at Orange, again launching the 3G service for Orange. So that's a bit about me, and look forward to tonight.
Paul from TOT, Tape It Off the Internet. And we're imminently launching, as we have been for a little while. To just do a rundown, if you guys haven't had a look at it, it's essentially kind of a search engine on one hand that finds all the places on the internet where you can watch or download TV shows, whether it's from a retail like iTunes, or it's on YouTube, or it's on BitTorrent, or any of those places in between. And we also have a big sort of wiki-style community-generated content space around that too. And it's all quite groovy. And we have a big social network around that, and that's kind of what Teoti is. You'll all see it quite soon, I hope. My background generally is as a designer in new media for the past 10, 15 years. So I've sort of seen both sides of agency and client trying to make cool things for new media at the cutting edge, and the TV internet space is certainly the place to be at the moment. That's me.
I'm Alex Cameron. I'm a cocky little upstart who thinks he knows it all, and run a company called Digital TX based in Mayfair. We acquire content from movie studios, record labels. I write a lot, speak a lot, so my profile's quite high, and I'm planning this evening on giving you the no bullshit view, where we cut through everything and just tell it like it is.
I'm Alan Patrick. I started a company called Broadsight about 3 years ago. Before that, I was managing director of a company that did triple play into the cable, TV and IP worlds. And before that, I was at BT doing video on demand in Web 1 and all that. We started Broadsight because we could see that digital broadband media and Web 2 were coming together. And there was quite a lot happening in that space. And web TV really is one of these areas where they're coming together totally, where you're seeing, you know, broadband media plus web 2 things like social media and so on. What do we do? Anything from helping startups to get to first funding to helping large corporates to think about how they're going to deal with this new area. And we've worked in everything from the front end, from sort of content strategy all the way to the back end, and divining new devices and so on and so forth. So hopefully I'll be able to put some structure around the market, because that's one of the things we do.
Okay, terrific. Thanks very much. Futurescape, my own company, is specializing at the moment in researching into brand marketing via video social networks and explaining how major brands can use YouTube effectively to communicate and actually sell out to the internet audience. Now, moving on, this evening it's very much a feature of Chinwag events, so they're pretty informal. So what we're going to do is have a bit of discussion, about 30 to 45 minutes up here amongst the panel, and we will be taking questions during the panel discussion. And after that, there'll be a full-on Q&A for about another 45 minutes. So to kick off the panel part of the discussion, what I'd like to do first of all is invite some of the panel members to actually help us define the terms. Because the terms IPTV, WebTV, P2P, they have been used interchangeably and in different meanings over the years. So I'd like to get Alexander and Cosmo to kick off with, what is IPTV? And what's the difference between that and what we see as a web-delivered service?
Glad we've started with definitions, actually, because this is probably the most important part, because IPTV is quite confusing, to say the least. And we're going to try and be clear and try and be slow and structured about this. Firstly, IPTV stands for Internet Protocol Television. Very simple, basic thing. Ultimately, what it is, it comes down to one sentence. It's television or video delivered using internet technology. In the past, when we did broadcast television, we sent a signal one way promiscuously across any kind of territory where there was a satellite footprint or a cable footprint. But what would happen is the signal would be one way. So anyone could tune in, but we all got the same copy of the same broadcast. IPTV changes a little bit of that. It changes the playing field and the way that things are done, the way that we receive television. So like when we go and receive a personal copy of a website, when we go to visit Yahoo or any of these other places, we ask for a personal copy, we send a request, and we get a response. We have a personal connection of some kind with the website, with the resource at the other end. Television or video that's used which is delivered in a way so much that we ask for it and then someone responds and we have a personalized relationship via an internet technology. It's IPTV. So ultimately, IPTV is actually a family of technologies. It can mean anything. There are lots of different types of IPTV. Generally speaking, it's associated with cable television that's sent down a phone line, like Home Choice, like things that are in the US. But ultimately, it can mean any of these things. So the best thing, and the very first thing that everyone's got to get in their minds is this is an umbrella term. And we're going to split that up into certain sort of departments. We're going to say, okay, there's the internet, then there's the privately managed networks like Home Choice, and then there's all these sort of strange hybrid products like BT Vision. The other thing which is probably worth pointing out, something like YouTube is classified as IPTV simply because it's television or video sent over the net. Home Choices as well, but you've obviously probably heard of Video On Demand, which is where we send video across a network, but we have the same kind of controls that we do on a VCR, like a rewind, fast forward. Video On Demand, this is a bit confusing, is a form of IPTV because it's video delivered using an internet-style technology. But ultimately, these things are about having a personalized relationship with the person who is distributing or broadcasting the video, hence the so-called revolutionary part of this technology. It comes from the US, where cable companies and telecom companies have been sitting there scrapping for who's going to own the communications hub into people's homes. If you're a big fat American with a baseball cap watching some crap American gladiators, you'd be doing it through cable. If you were going to be doing it through, you know, speaking to your long-lost aunt in New York, it's going to be through some Bell telephone company. They both scrapped for the internet access. Cable decided they were going to do telephone. The telephone companies decided they were going to do TV, hence telco TV, hence so-called triple play, quadruple play. But ultimately, take back and let it be absorbed. IPTV is a definition for a family of technologies.
Okay, for tonight's purposes, can we define IPTV as internet protocol delivered to a set-top box to a TV?
No. To put it bluntly, any device which is capable of have internet connectivity can display IPTV. So if you have a set-top box which has IP connectivity, like a BT Vision box, like a Tiscali box, if you have a games console which has connectivity like an Xbox 360, you have a mobile phone which has IP or Bluetooth, a PDA, anything, any device that can display video or television using IP technology, it could be classified as an IP reception device, if you like.
Okay, so every screen that can take in internet is basically an IPTV device in your definition?
Yeah, very much so, yeah.
Okay, fine.
I think the only thing I'd add to that, and it's probably going to confuse things further, Colin, you're doing a great job of trying to get some definitions here, but in our world, looking through a slightly more sort of commercial perspective at this, there's two kinds of platforms that we look at in terms of distributing our on-demand content. There's closed platforms, closed VOD platforms, and open VOD platforms. I think probably the closed VOD platform is pretty close to what Colin is trying to get us to define as IPTV. By closed, it means essentially there's a closed user group. So Virgin Media has TV subscribers. Tiscali TV has the same. BT Vision is working in that direction. There may be others that come along in the future. Those are closed platforms. For us, they're closed deals. We understand how many subscribers there are, and we can manage that content with a reasonable degree of control. Open TV platforms or open VOD platforms are very different. Those are things like, for example, 4OD, our own PC internet service, YouTube, Google Video in its old days, Juiced. Juice is a very good example. Trying to offer a TV experience, but very much along the internet lines, in other words, open to everybody. So for us, when we are looking to run our business and do distribution deals, we have a very different approach to closed platforms and open platforms. Maybe that helps. Or maybe not.
No, that's fine.
I was just going to say, to add to that, is probably getting closer to what constitutes closed, because you say closed platform, you can also say, well, you have to have a registered subscriber or not. And it's for the definition part of that, with a Tiscali or a Home Choice style service, the physical network, isn't it? The actual telephone line that comes from someone's house, runs up to the telephone exchange, into the Home Choice center, is exclusively controlled by Home Choice, and the content runs from place to place, whereas an open network generally tends to be available over the internet. I think, would that be a... I think, because open closed just means, locked out. And okay. It's tricky. It's one of those things you get like a... People say they don't realize that when those types of services are coming over, they're not actually connecting to the internet, but they are running over the telephone line, so to speak, I guess.
Okay, so we can tentatively agree on open versus closed. And Raghav, do you have any thoughts on that?
There are many, don't get me wrong, but not all. the way we look at the world, I think, is very similar to, I think, what Cosmo just articulated, which is that you've got closed sort of IPTV systems, and you can think about them closed in two different ways. One is from the user perspective, where you have to have some relationship, some sign-up process or authentication with the provider, and then also from the content owner perspective. So in other words, if you wanted to get onto Home Choice or 4D or one of these other products, you'd have to do a deal with the gateway provider or the aggregator, if you will. Whereas over with web TV, as we define it, it's over the open internet. So anybody today can go on and publish something and make it available to the web without having to go through any gatekeeper per se. And I think that's how we sort of look at the world and divide it up into the sort of web TV versus internet TV. And I think certainly in the U.S. There are these telcos, as you were referring to, that are investing billions of dollars in fiber optic lines and everything else to try and really replicate the coaxial cable kind of model and bring television into homes in a cable model, subscription, and sort of aggregate a bunch of different channels. And so that's not what Brightcove is doing, and that's not what we would consider sort of web TV, which is, as Cosmo was referring to, products and services like YouTube, and even if you go to skysports.com and see some interviews and video highlights, that's what we would call web TV.
Okay, terrific. Maybe bring Paul in at this point and look at P2P distribution as a subset of web TV, tentatively.
Yeah, this is a bit more fuzzy and probably a bit shorter, and it overlaps a lot of the other ones too, in that I think... Boiling it down to a very simple definition is P2P distribution doesn't require a central source to come from. So it comes from a group of people sharing a file. This has been going back to Napster days, I guess. But on video, it has to be a bit slicker, and a lot of the problems have been solved. For example, Juice is a P2P distribution mechanism. It does have some central seeding, but it's kind of based around the P2P stuff, person to person, and it seems to play back real telly in real time. The 4OD system again is not real time, but it also uses a person to person distribution system. What that is basically we're us, the distributors, instead of paying for all the bandwidth ourselves, are kind of stealing it from you, the consumer, a little bit.
Okay, terrific. Can we make a distinction between downloads and streaming and the thing that YouTube does that looks like streaming but isn't?
Is YouTube streaming and isn't it?
It's a flash progressive download.
I guess what you could say the difference is, theoretically, when you've got something like a file that's hosted on a server, like a JPEG file or a flash video file, it's just coming... Going to be slightly techie on this one. I don't know how many techie people are, so if I get really nerdy, I'm sorry, put your hands up and scream or something. It's a file that's being taken off a web server. It is a kind of pseudo stream, is what I'd call it. It's a file that's being dragged off a web server somewhere, whereas real time live streaming, the actual transmission is controlled by a server somewhere.
And the technology that YouTube uses, flash streaming, is kind of halfway in between. If you use the proper flash media server, if you pause it, it'll stop sending data. It'll send a call back to stop sending data, whereas if it's just a download, it'll just keep coming and coming and coming until it's finished. And that's not P2P.
Okay, terrific. Right, now we've done all the definitions. But I thought the main part of the evening is going through business models and then on to consequences for broadcasts and any producers. So Alan's very kindly volunteered to give us an overview of how he sees the structure of the whole industry from content to end user as a starting point for the business model as part of the discussion. So, Alan, if you'd like to take it away.
Okay, well, one of the issues, obviously, is definition. So I'll have to define what I mean by the various terms. But this is the expurgated version of a much larger piece of work we normally do. But in essence, if you look at this industry today, there's a pick-and-mix Darwinian experimentation going on. If you look at the old media model with the four-box model with content production, then aggregation, then onto distribution, then onto something that the user actually uses, what you're finding is a pick-and-mix being played at each point in that model. So if you look at, say, content, what you're seeing is people experimenting with user-generated content-based models. You're seeing people experimenting with studio production, either produced now or trying to use archives of some sort. Moving on to aggregation, seeing a huge amount of fermentation going on there. And really, if I put my consulting hat on, you really got a sort of two-by-two matrix, because you've got the people from the broadcast side coming in who really understand, you know, real-time 24/7 live output, and they understand the economics of the broadcasting side. On the other side, you've got the Web2 guys and, let's say, the new media guys coming. They understand the sort of impact of Metcalfe's law on network effects. And unfortunately, these two different types of network models meet in the middle, and it's unclear yet where the economics really work out, because it's hugely, and it varies by country as well right now. If you go into distribution, you've got a bunch of issues. One is, can you everybody's looking at distributing it over IP, but at the moment, what you've got is anybody who's sitting in the content side or the aggregation side is getting a free ride over the players who are effectively distributors in the IP space, and then the telcos don't like that. So at some point they're going to, let us not use the word throttle, but they're certainly going to think of ways of grading the service, because they're fairly fed up with people taking money, what they perceive of them. And as if you read the blogs and the discussions, you'll see there's a huge debate going on about the equitable distribution of revenue in that space. If you look at mobile, on the other hand, you would argue that the mobile IPTV players are taking too much money out the game and nothing's going upstream, and that industry's got its own problems. If you then get to what's happening right at the end, you again have got quite a lot of experimentation. You've got people using a set-top box model, which has two bad pieces of news. One is you've got to subsidize a set-top box, because by and large people don't buy these things, and they've got lots of them already, so it's not really viable to, say, buy a new set-top box from us. The second thing you've got to do is do a truck roll, which is to go out and help somebody set these things up. And if you ever looked at the economics of this chain, the truck roll is the killer piece of economics. So if you then look at the people using the PC as the free ride, you get a nice free model all the way to the PC. You then, effectively, the problem you've got, though, is that the PC experience is different to the big screen experience. So actually you have to, and the mobile experience one is different again, so you have to repurpose the content, and it's still a huge amount of experimentation to what actually works on a PC and on a mobile. The other problem you've got on a PC is you've got no lock-in whatsoever. You know, with the set-top box, you put all that money up, but you get lock-in. So it's a certain amount of closed model. But we did an experiment. So to move from Juiced to Babelgum, which are two competitors in this space, it took us, I think, about 5 minutes to download from one to the other, 5 minutes to set ourselves up, and 5 minutes to be playing. So, you know, you had a 15-minute shift. So there's absolutely zero lock-in on the sort of web TV. What we also define is what we call PC TV, which is which services allow you to take a PC, use it as a set-top box, and then run it up on a TV. And that's quite an interesting game in its own right, because some TVs allow you to do a direct VGA output into the TV, and some, and this is true, a lot of the HD TV in the US doesn't. So no doubt there is a space being deliberately left for a black box that will do that at some price to yourself. And that also has an impact, because the cost of ownership varies. So at this stage, it's hugely early in the market. There's massive experimentation going on. The other very simple thing about business models is there's only really two ways of getting money at the moment. One is you ask the user to pay you money, and the other is you ask the advertiser to pay you money. And there's nuances around those two. But in essence, if you look at right now, the story is the by and large, the user pays money for the distribution side and the equipment in the home, and for the content provider, they have to use advertising to subsidize that in some way or another. And then what you've got is quite a wide variety of how advertising works and so on and so on. That varies by country and varies by experience. So I think the only thing you can say about business models, that's a structure. You've got a massive pick and mix across that chain right now. You can pick any one of them. If you say Juiced, and you'll say, well, they're using fairly normal content. They're trying to use a very Web2-based social dynamic with some form of TV, EPG. They're going to get a free ride. onto your TV. That's great. If you take Paul's operation, he's got a slightly different model onto where the content comes from. But again, it's got a similar structure. If you take something like BT, what they're doing is effectively funding a lock-in model up to the set-top box. So, you know, huge experimentation. Not clear yet which one's going to win. So that's the structure of the market right now.
Okay, thanks, Alan. That's terrific. So if we let's just go down the panel and ask people, what do you think are going to be the winners and losers of the business models? We've got subscriptions, pay-per-view, ad-funded, catch-up viewing, download-to-own. There's just this huge dominating explosion of different nuances, as Alan was saying, of business models. You know, do you have any idea what's doing better and what's doing worse and in what spaces?
Yeah, well, so I think our perspective on this is that first, I think, as to sort of echo what Alan was saying, there's a lot of experimentation that's been going on in the past 18 months, and I think that's going to continue for a little bit, and with all sorts of different business models, and you have pay media products and services, so pay-per-view subscriptions, even pay-per-minute, and one thing we're seeing there is that the demand from that is, you know, it's sort of at best an ancillary, fairly incremental business line for people where, especially, and obviously it will depend on the content you have. So if you have full-length movies, then certainly rentals and pay per use products or models will be very applicable to you. But for TV shows, you'll sell some product over iTunes and 5.tv or some of these other websites, but really what we're seeing is a burgeoning demand for ad-supported content, both from an end-user perspective and also from the advertising community, where they sort of like the idea of the targetability, the accountability of the new medium, and really the new creative palette that it offers them. There are some challenges on the advertising side, which we were actually talking about amongst ourselves prior to this, in terms of organizational inertia, et cetera. But that really seems to be a very, at least in our perspective, something that's really becoming very popular is free to the end user, ad-supported content. Metrics aren't there yet, the standards aren't there yet, but that's really the direction we see the market headed from a demand perspective.
Do we have any idea from US perspective of what kind of advertising may work? I mean, we've seen all sorts of experiments with pre-roll, post-roll, different lengths, 30 seconds down to a suggested 5 seconds, and then the Google ad overlays.
So that's right. I mean, there is a lot of experimentation going on. I think the as with any new medium, the content, and in this case, you can consider advertising content, it's been repurposed, right? So you've got agencies that have TV spots. They've been cleared. They've been approved by the client. And so they want to put them on because that's the easy thing to do, and it sort of fits their workflow. And so we've had a lot of, in the past few years, had a lot of 30-second spots that came on, which was a terrible user experience. And so you had a lot of distributors and publishers push back on that, ourselves included, and actually turn down money for campaigns and saying, no, we draw the line at 15 seconds. And by the way, we'd prefer them to be 5 seconds or 8 seconds. That is evolving, but a lot of publishers will understandably take the money and run a 30-second spot pre-roll wise. Now, you may have heard recently YouTube really went with the overlay model, which we're very bullish on. In fact, we'd sort of introduced that as a prototype in 2005. But the issue there is some of the organizational challenges that I was referring to earlier. Which is that agencies today they really like the creative and the prospects of it, but they're not really set up to do it. They're not used to creating that kind of creative for online. Then they have to, even if they do the creative, or if you, the publisher, actually do the creative for them, they then have to run it back up the chain to get approval from the actual client, and that takes time. And these agencies, and I'm sure there's some people here in the audience, as you know, you're frazzled for time, and so that's been a challenge, right? But with large sort of critical mass distributors like a YouTube adopting this new standard, that will help the entire market move to a model that a lot of people think will be more end-user friendly, which is the overlay model.
Just in case anybody hasn't actually seen it yet, the YouTube overlay starts off at about 10 seconds into the video. It comes up over the top 20% as a semi-transparent overlay inviting you to click. And if you do click to see the advertisement comes up full screen for a number of seconds over the top of the original video, which then pauses while you're watching the ad. When the ad goes away, you start watching the video again. So in case you haven't seen that, that's what we're actually talking about in terms of the YouTube overlay. So, Cosmo?
Be interesting to find out how many people watch those ads. That's a separate question, I think. In terms of business models, one of the most important parts of my job and of the VOD team at Channel 4 is to test different business models. I don't know how many of you are familiar with 4OD, hopefully many of you. But on the PC, when we launched back in December, it was almost an entirely pay-per-view service. 99p to download an episode of any of our content from the last month or from our 25-year history. Since then, we have released progressively increasing amounts of free ad-supported content, particularly around catch-up. So back in March, we went free with the last 7 days of catch-up, and then just a couple of weeks ago, we extended that to a month. There's a couple of things driving that. The first thing I'd say is that the reason that we started with pay-per-view was as much around expediency of getting a product out there quickly as it was about a sort of inherent belief within Channel 4 that pay-per-view was the only model that was going to work. There was a lot of debate about which business model to launch with. The decision to go pay-per-view was largely because we felt that that was the easiest way to convince a critical stakeholder in this business from our perspective, and that is our independent production company partners from whom we commission all our content. We felt it was the easiest and best approach to getting something approved and agreed by them so that we could carry them through the launch of 4OD. As I say, since then we've released increasing amounts of content free to view, both on a streamed and downloaded basis. And we just extended that a couple of weeks ago, mainly in response to very strong demand from the advertising community for inventory, pre-roll inventory in front of our VOD content. Now, we have a very simple playlist. We run up to 30-second spots in front of our content. We are the first to recognise that's the first step in a long evolution, and I think that what Rags has been saying about the US is absolutely valid. We look to the US very much for developments in ad technology and ad innovation generally. However, having said that, we have had a bump a few months on 4OD from an advertising perspective, and long may that continue. I think the other thing, though, about advertising is that right now, one of the reasons we're doing so well, I believe, is because of the kind of fundamentals of supply and demand, that there isn't very much supply out there, really, and there's quite a lot of demand from agencies, many of whom might be just experimenting and trying things out, but there's demand there anyway. I think we may be coming up to a kind of inflection point around supply with the launch of other video services across a whole range of different websites. I mean, everybody wants to get video onto their website now. So I think over the next few months we're going to see a huge upsurge in available supply of ad inventory, and that's going to have some quite significant effects on ad prices. But that's my feedback on advertising. What I would say is that it also drives views enormously. So yes, I agree, people want free content as much as they can. Having said that, I think there are some other pay models that we're very keen not to kind of throw out the baby with the bathwater, if you like, that we don't want to just go completely free until we've fully tested other models. I'm a great believer in, for example, subscription. I think subscription, you know, anyone who runs a P&L likes subscription because it's got nice fat margins. You play on the fact that people are too lethargic to switch off their subscription when they're not using your content, and off you go, you make lots of money. I think subscriptions are extremely difficult to launch in any context. And I think the internet has seen lots of subscription models that haven't necessarily worked all that well. Newspapers are a case in point. So we haven't launched a subscription product on 4OD, but we've been watching that market a lot and considering a lot of different models to wrap subscriptions around, many of which I think are still quite compelling if we can get the proposition right. The other thing I'd say on subscription is that there's one market where subscription has worked incredibly well, and we benefit from that in our video on demand business, and that is the TV. pay TV, subscription TV, is a fantastically successful business, and the VOD services of Virgin Media, for example, Tiscali TV, and BT Vision, to some extent, are all based around subscription. So we benefit hugely from that, and we shouldn't write off subscription in the VOD environment without considering the benefit of the TV platform from a revenue and bottom line perspective. So in summary, lots of different business models. We are trying our best to try them all out, see what works. I think we're doing pretty well at it so far, and look forward to the market continuing to evolve.
Any ideas on what how the pricing might settle down for an individual TV show? There's an article in the FT this weekend which noted that you could get a Grey's Anatomy would cost you $1.89 per episode on iTunes versus 99p on Five. So I mean, that's a big price difference per episode.
That's nothing like the price difference you see on DVDs. I mean, you can pick up a DVD box set of Peep Show, for example, which is one of Channel 4's classic programs, for probably minimum price $5.99, I should think, off the internet. Maximum price Amazon, or even a bricks and mortar retailer, $13.99. So that kind of price variation is nothing compared to what you see in some more traditional retail markets. Having said which, yes, of course, prices need to standardize. iTunes has just launched at $1.89. That's got to be a fairly, well, they would certainly hope for that to be a dominant force. I'm not going to say whether it will be or not.
You think it would be downward pressure on prices?
Downward pressure on prices. Well, we retail DTO on our platform at $1.99. It's a very limited business at this point because DTO, download to own, so you pay £1.99 and you get to download and then keep forever the episode of Peep Show, Shameless, Skins, whatever it might be. It's a very small business for us at the moment because we haven't fully figured out our proposition. In particular, we don't have a device strategy, and that is why people might put their money behind Apple iTunes with their Apple TV box, or behind Microsoft Xbox, or other platforms that have a means of getting that content onto your TV, because that's where the mass market will want to watch it. We don't have that, so we don't have enormous numbers behind the DTO business on our own 4OD platform, but we think that distributing DTO content across other platforms is certainly something that we'll be looking at in the future. I can't remember what the question was. Did I answer it?
You answered splendidly. Okay, let's go on to Paul. Paul, P2P.
Yeah,
does P2P have a business model? Do you have a business model? Does it matter if you do or you don't?
Well, I mean, our view is much like Alan's in that, you know, there's so much going on, people trying out different business models, and I think there's a lot more to be tried out yet. And because of, you know, what we are, we're an aggregator of essentially mechanisms to get the content rather than directly distributing the content ourselves. You know, we're in a space that where it's just very interesting, and we can see which models are working better than others. You know, useful information for everyone involved, I'm sure. And you know, we're also keen to see the content makers get involved in this and you know, bypass the distribution old school a little bit and start taking a risk and raising some money and distributing their own content for cash, or raise money and sell advertising and see how that fits into the model. And again, that crosses over into other stuff, which is, you know, the more user-generated things, and then there's paid user-generated. And you know, so we're quite happy with everyone trying out all these business models, and I'm sure there'll be some distinct ones that stand out, maybe not for 3 years yet. This is, you know, a long way away. And the other reason we you know, don't pick any particular business model is that at the end of the day, for the user experience, people are having trouble getting the content they want to watch on the device they want to watch it. So whatever works for them, fine, you know. So that's another reason to list every possible option of doing it. And our business model essentially at the moment is partly advertising based. And because there's all these different business models through various distributors, partly going to be revenue share on that too.
Tanda, you're making lots of notes there.
I'm really glad you asked me this. I don't quite know what business models really means. I have an extraordinary amount of respect for people who do lots of academics and MBAs and that kind of thing to put paperwork together. I think the question is really simple. How do you make money? And to put it even more bluntly, I don't know how you make money. How do you make a profit? I think academics are great, but when you're getting really down onto the trenches, when you've got blood on your hands and sweat and dirt, it's an entirely different matter. I'll tell you what is the number one business model, which I think anyone's noticed, and the head of Disney pointed out a little while ago, is piracy. Piracy is a business model. And I don't care who agrees or disagrees with that, that is the truth. There is a digital distribution market sitting out there at the moment. There were, I think, was it Sean Fanning from Snowcap, ex-Napster guy, said, yeah, iTunes managed a billion downloads last year, but they didn't tell you about the 99 billion other illegal downloads. Piracy is a business model, and I think that's going to work out that way. And I think we are perilous to even consider shutting out the door. We don't like talking about it. We don't think it's a very polite thing. We, the content owners, think it's offensive. There's a market, there's a distribution market out there of people who are downloading from BitTorrent instead of 4OD. That is what is winning the day right now. That's the kind of competition we face. When people aren't downloading from video on demand services or anything else, they are doing things in a way that we don't want them to. To be really blunt and sort of quick about these things, download to own, I just think sucks, to be honest. I had a very long conversation with, I'm not going to, she's going to remain nameless, a lady at Universal, which they launched with Love Film. I'm really, really gutted Craig Sullivan's not here, or he might be, from Love Film, because him and I always get into a very sort of, excitable argument about this, where their reasoning for doing download to own or burn your own DVDs was because there was a rights window issue where they couldn't introduce a new video on demand release window straight after because of all the existing contracts they had. So they managed to negotiate the fact that download to own was an extension of DVD rental, DVD release, and the stats weren't exactly impressive. And the same goes for pay-per-view. If you look into the pay-per-view model, you go into any studio, you're going to see that pay-per-view actually doesn't make any money. And I could go into the stats for a very, very long time, but the way that people make money out of pay-per-view is they charge very, very large minimum guarantees to people who buy the rights to distribute it. The actual money that comes through from pay-per-view isn't amazingly good. I mean, that's direct feedback from studios. These are painful truths that people don't want to hear. It's not very nice. I don't think anyone has any idea how they're going to make money, to be perfectly honest. And I think it's open chaos. Juiced are going to do exactly what they did with Skype and Gazelle. They're going to build something, a bunch of open source software, put some TV thing on the top of it, and they're going to sell out to someone like Viacom and make a whole lot of money in the same way that YouTube did. Yeah, that's fairly standard stuff. I don't really call that a business model. BT, I don't even know how they're doing. Last thing I heard, they had 30,000 subscribers, pushing for 100,000 by the end of the year. Vodafone were going to launch a branded service or something like that. I think it's not easy to tell. And I think there is an element of experimentation here, but I think we have to get out of ivory towers a little bit and actually see how people are doing things on the ground. Now, subscription's great, but it doesn't scale very well, technically. I mean, if you look at the statistics of it, you'll see in Eastern Europe and other places like this that subscription video on demand is going up about 40%, and that in compound interest, the excitement and the demand for it, but it's not great in terms of sort of distribution. I would say, and I think one of the most important things, this is going to sound a little strange, but I think we've got to watch porn companies. And not for the reasons that you would generally expect. Because wherever porn guys go, we follow. Porn guys did the first credit card subscription or payments on the net. They're doing the first live premium rate screening streams now. Admittedly, they do have a very much a pay-per-view based model for obvious reasons, because they're trying to make the money out of dirty old men. And in case, just out of interest, there's a very funny statistic that the average, I think it's like the average porn line conversation is 3.5 minutes, and the average viewing time in a hotel is 9.5 minutes. So I don't know what the potential is for advertising supported revenue in there, but presumably it's 9 minutes of premium rate stream. I would say if we're gonna talk about it, I think Narrowstep are in for serious trouble with Bright Cove, serious trouble, and I think what you guys do kicks ass.
Just say who Narrowstep are, what they do.
I'm going to get into a lot of trouble with this, because last time I mentioned Narrowstep, their PR company called me. And I got taken in to meet the CEO, and who gave me, attempted to give me a ticking off, which was hilarious. What Bright Cove have done, which I think is very brave, and I think these guys are going to come out on top, and I have enormous respect for everyone who's sitting on here, because these guys are all doing something amazing, they're doing something pioneering, and they don't know where they're going to go. We don't know. But Narrowstep were like an internet TV streaming company. They were supposed to be like an internet TV station, and they signed up 80 or 90 people, I think. Windows Media, DRM style stuff, charged people £30,000 set up, a couple of £1,000 a month here. Nobody started making any money. People came up with things like railway TV and sale TV. Nobody watched it. It sucked. They tried to do big deals with carriers. Didn't work. Then Brightco came along, blew them out of the water. And everyone just deserted en masse over there because it's free. You make money from advertising. So what I said to them was quite blunt was, look, you need to do, if you're going to compete with Brightcove, which is where everyone's going right now, you need to offer a free service and then you need a premium step up. They didn't like that very much. So they fired the CEO, got rid of all the management team. They're currently on a downward spiral to selling the big issue, I think, to be perfectly honest with you. I agree that advertising
support... The PR contract is in the mail.
Thank you very much. That's £1,000 for you this evening. Did I say that was a very, very nice tweed jacket you were wearing? That's absolutely right. I bet he's got a very beautiful wife as well. Right. Advertising supported revenue, there's a whole bunch of long tail content. Long tail's wicked because it's one of those things that there's real sales evidence for. It's real life stuff. And let's just be blunt here. We have to be real. We have to be honest about these things. Because otherwise we're not going to get anywhere with honesty. We're just going to sit with a bunch of MBA qualified people in a room theorizing about something where actually my bank manager doesn't talk about value when I get my bank statement. He's usually, you know, a shade of red and looking like he's going to smash something. The value on these things is largely determined by investors. Investors pay money when they buy businesses out. What broadcast television has done for 30, 40 years, something like that, has sold advertising in programs. Aggregators that are channels, TV channels that buy up content from production companies and they put ads in it to fund it. What is going to happen effectively is just that model is just going to go over to what's basically the content on the net. It's not tricky.
Okay, yeah, that's an interesting point. Let me pick up on that. Is it possible that advertising can actually go out of broadcast TV? I mean, that's, I believe, Channel 4 has been mentioning that as a possibility, that advertising revenue can simply migrate out of television onto the internet generally, not just in video, but in other things like you know, AdWords and so on. And there's actually a long-term threat to television because advertising will simply leave TV.
Yes.
So...
So that's why we put in a plea to Ofcom that we need support as our traditional means of public service broadcaster support trickles away through the analog spectrum. We need support because our business model doesn't work. One of the great fundamentals, which is the revenue driver, is changing very, very
significantly. Why should, I mean, this is a tricky one. Why am I going to?
I think perhaps, Colin, you might have been saying the question you might have been looking for was, will the internet substitute all the revenue that is driven off the TV at this point? And that, I think, is an open question for which I don't think anyone's qualified to answer at this point. But at this point, evidence would suggest that no, it won't.
This is the question for me, which I have with anyone. It wouldn't necessarily come to Channel 4, because you guys have just got amazingly compelling content, to be perfectly honest. Why would I go and buy or download Peep Show when I can download it off BitTorrent? I know it's okay, illegal and immoral and unethical, all that kind of thing, but I mean, there are people who are 15, 16 years old who have grown up doing this now. They expect content to be free. Where's the driver in me doing it? If I want to download a DVD to burn, I have to go and buy the DVD, you have to circumvent the DRM, I need to download it or burn it three times. And I think when we're taking business models into consideration, we need to start looking at some of the things that are preventing that money from being made. I think that's the first question.
I think your point about piracy as a business model is absolutely right, and I think it's a valid point to include in the conversation. Why should people download Peep Show from 4OD rather than off BitTorrent? Well, no particular reason. If they're comfortable using BitTorrent and it's for free and you have to pay for it on 4OD, then why would you? You don't have to pay for it on 4OD unless you want to download to keep it, and I think that's a different proposition. So yes, of course, the pirates are our greatest competitor. And we need to come up with strategies of convincing people to consume our content through legal means rather than illegal means, of course. And that's precisely why we're building these businesses and looking to make money out of them. Just one other point, though. In terms of download to own, I think that there's a as a community and there's a sort of social phenomenon that you shouldn't forget when you think about things like download to own, which is around collections and collectors. I think it's absolutely the case with music that if you love a band, and I talk to many people out there who are huge fans of different Channel 4 shows, Shameless addicts, for example, Skins addicts, who will say, you know, whatever format you want to give us the content in, I'll go out and get it and I'll buy it and I'll spend money on it. I'll buy the box set in HMV at Christmas. If you had it on iTunes, I'd download the box set there and keep it on my computer. I'll watch your free stream content on 4OD. I'll watch it on BitTorrent as well. I'll consume as much as I can. So I think I'm actually a believer, before the market has developed, if I had to put money on it, I'd say that DTO, download to own, will develop as a business of some scale because you can make good revenue off it, good price points, and I think there's a willingness, there's an appetite in the market for collecting content in a digital format.
Just one question. I mean, you're the only broadcaster here, but is there any reason why you have to own the distribution channel on the internet? Can't you just distribute your content on BitTorrent with ads burnt into the video? Is there any problem with that?
In principle, no, we could do that if that was the business model that we chose, but there's a couple of reasons why we wouldn't do that. First of all, from a value perspective, we think that there's value to be made in extending the way that Channel 4 does business at the moment, which is through advertising in front of content in a relatively controlled environment. We think there's value in extending that into the new world of the internet, which is what we're doing on 4OD. Should we look to distribute content beyond 4OD? I think absolutely we should, yes. We have to do it on the terms that are right for us and are right for the other stakeholders in our business. Most importantly, I'll say it again, the independent production companies who actually make the content that we have the rights to. Both they and us prefer a degree of control in terms of how the content is presented, the quality in which people can consume it, the various other aspects of the proposition, the digital content proposition. And so that's, I think, a compelling reason why we shouldn't just leave it up to internet distribution channels with no degree of control, be they legal or illegal. I think we have to strike a balance between the two, and it's a very difficult balance to strike, especially in these early days, but it's one of the things that we are investigating and testing right now.
No, let's move on to the indies and how they might be able to benefit. And is there actually a way in which all of this can improve your situation as an independent producer and give you new channels to market? I mean, Paul was having a few thoughts about that in the run-up to the panel discussion.
I don't think anyone's actually put a price on per viewer, profit. So essentially you have, 20 million people watching an episode of Lost, and that has a certain price that people are making out of it based on the ads. But, if you can pre-sell stuff, I mean, J.J. Abrams has now a credibility and a name that can be pre-sold. He has a new show coming out next year, which, could potentially be pre-sold on subscription with a much smaller audience, but still make as much profit for the content creators while bypassing the whole distribution mechanism. This is something that the top-end content creators should start looking at. That, and also buying their own ads in if they've got a big enough name lined up. It's not something that's out of whack. And, when you have the distribution mechanisms of the internet, which no longer have scarcity that the airwaves have and even digital television has, you're in a different space altogether for people that make stuff that people want to watch. And I think that's going to change a big deal. And people like Channel 4 especially, who commission almost all their content, could be in a very difficult space.
Cosmo?
Anyone else want? we could be, yes. However, I think we've got quite a compelling proposition to the indies ourselves. I mean, there's a sort of fundamental question. Should the indies go and distribute their content directly themselves? Should they set up their own content aggregation or content distribution portals? Or should they do it through us? They're absolutely at liberty to do whatever they like, so long as we haven't already got the rights to that content. It all comes down to rights at the end of the day. But I do think we've got quite a compelling proposition for why they should do it with us. We've got an extremely powerful marketing engine. We've got a very powerful and compelling and popular consumer brand. We've got an advertising business that we can put to work behind their content, et cetera, et cetera. There's a long list, and I think it's quite compelling. Perhaps they should look to work with us as well, which brings me on to the sort of more important point, which is I think that there's all sorts of opportunities opening up now for independent production companies and producers, people who want to put content out and get people to watch it. I think that going through traditional lines, i.e. broadcasters like us, is one good way to do it, because we have very well-established relationships with producers, which has generated some fantastic content in the past. I think they should also be out there testing other ways of doing things, absolutely. I mean, I think that this technical change should lead to huge changes and huge leaps in creativity, new business models, new ideas, new creative formats, you name it. I think there's lots of opportunity out there, and I would never suppose that everything should remain the same and the broadcaster will always maintain a presence in the value chain. However, I do think we've got quite a compelling case in certain situations.
In here, because as Brightcove, you've had experience of being an aggregator, which sounds like the ideal place to be in this in the new business models that are emerging. That supposedly, according to the MBA types, the value is shifting away from actually owning the content to aggregating it, which is why YouTube is so valuable. But Brightcove ran into some problems with actually trying to be a video aggregator. Maybe you'd like to go through some of that with us.
Yeah, sure. So, you know, the way we look at the world and the way what we counsel our clients and our partners on is to adopt what we call a blended distribution strategy. And what that means is that if you could sort of consider your content being sort of in the center and having different spokes out of that hub, you'll have your own sort of owned and operated websites as some of those spokes, but you'll also have other distribution platforms that make up other spokes, and so, you know, we encourage our clients to view those different spokes in a holistic way. So, you know, for instance, we have some people experimenting with windowing, so they may have content that debuts on their own site for 24 or 48 hours, and then after that, they'll then start distributing it out to the various distribution points. And you know, we think that makes a lot of sense, you know, for that particular content owner. I think that one thing we're seeing is that certainly there are distributors out there, YouTubes, you know, the Bebos, the MySpaces of the world, that are getting, you know, scale and critical mass, and the network effects that they're able to get through the community that they have built in are very powerful. And so they're getting... they're actually increasing their market share over time. And so, you know, I think that it'll be very interesting to see how it all plays out. But, you know, one, I think content owners will feel pressure to distribute through a lot of these aggregators. On the other hand, I think you'll also find some of these aggregators actually competing with the content, with the broadcasters and actually commissioning content. And certainly the recent Bebo success with the Kate Modern show is a great sort of a first step of that, but I think we're going to see more and more of that.